This is a CNA podcast.
The highest voter turnout in a century in what has been called the most polarized US presidential election in memory. After what can be only described as tumultuous, the questions on everybody's minds going into Wednesday, November 3rd, was whether Donald Trump would keep the White House. Now, Mr. Trump has been called divisive, ineffective, and unfit for the top job by his critics, but his supporters have turned up at his rallies in droves. They see him as a straight-talking leader, tackling issues on immigration, jobs and trade, and getting tough on China. His opponent, former Vice President Joe Biden, has mounted an impressive campaign with running mate Kamala Harris. Polls showing him maintaining a remarkably huge and steady lead over Mr. Trump since he captured the Democratic nomination. Yet here we are, a day after results began to trickle in, and not really closer to a firm conclusion. No candidate has gotten to the elusive 270 electoral votes needed. Biden is at 264 and Trump at 214. Votes for Nevada, Georgia, Pennsylvania, North Carolina and Alaska are still outstanding, but Mr. Trump has declared victory while Mr. Biden said yesterday it ain't over until every vote is counted. It is Thursday, November 5th, 10 a.m. and I'm Lin Su Ling. In a special edition of Heart of the Matter, I have with me to discuss the events of the last 24 hours. Singapore Ambassador to the US from 1996 to 2012 and Ambassador at Large, Ms. Chan Heng Chi, and Managing Director of Bauer Group Asia, James Caruso. Welcome to the show, both.
Thank you.
Now, Ambassador Chan, maybe you could start us off your quick thoughts. What comes to your mind when you look back over the last 24 hours?
Well, America is a divided society, 50% Republicans, 50% Democrats. And the two sides are really fighting to the finish. But this particular election is a fight to the end for both sides, almost, if you want, for the soul of the nation. Whose America will prevail? And it didn't start, this divisiveness, with Donald Trump, President Trump. It started quite a while ago, and I think even when President Bill Clinton was in office, there were the culture wars going, and the Republicans mounted a very strong resistance to his policies. So the culture wars are there, and America is divided. Is it going to be an America that is for, you know, pro-life, that is, you know, for Americans, America first? Is it going to be an internationalist America of the Wilsonian type? So there are different views here. Diversity, where do you put LGBT issues and so on? You see both groups, Republicans and Democrats, fighting for the version of America they want. You have a far higher turnout this time, I think, than any other time. I haven't seen the figures of the turnout yet. Average American elections are 60 over, and that's good. Sometimes it's 50+% turning up. So you're seeing something different.
Well, Ambassador Chan's right. U.S. society has been splitting urban, rural, coastal, interior, college-educated, non-college-educated, and by race. And it's exacerbated by globalization. There's no longer the ability to sort of hide, as it were, within your group and feel comfortable. There's also racial division, frankly. A non-college-educated white person could count on a decent job and frankly feel he would get it before the black guy. And now he may not get the job and he may not get it before the black guy. And that is a big change in attitude and culture, and they're angry. They're angry at the elites. They're angry at globalization, who they feel everyone doesn't play fair. And this is the reaction. We have 320 million Americans. It's hard to generalize. But I think that's the big culture split that the ambassador was referring to.
James, what do you think explains Mr. Trump's ability to hold on to such a huge number of voters? After all, in 2016, while some people say that, yes, it's a backlash against globalization, he represented a huge group of non-college educated whites and even more who felt a backlash against globalization. Some people thought he was an anomaly. Are you saying that he's not an anomaly?
I think he's the id of a lot of people. He says things that people feel and think, but before it wasn't correct to say it. And now he says it for them, no matter how outrageous it may appear. And when you're angry or you feel you're being told you can't say those things, and he says it for you, that's part of the power he has, as many populists in history have had. He generates excitement by digging into the deepest fears and concerns of a large section of the population.
One more question before I go to Ambassador Chan. Are more Americans angrier because Mr. Trump has gotten more votes this time compared to 2016, more of the popular vote?
Both sides were highly energized. The choice was so stark. The electorate was told the voice is stark, the vote is stark, and the decision is very meaningful. So both sides got out in droves. And as the ambassador said, we've had a record turnout. And for democracy, you know, record turnout is not a bad thing at all because it does provide even more legitimacy to the winner.
I would not discount the fact that President Trump ran a good campaign. He did the traditional thing. Door to door, the Republicans had a ground game. In fact, around September, I read a piece in Financial Times which said a Financial Times reporter went to the districts, to the states, and said he didn't see much of an organization for the Democrats. And he said there's no ground game because most of them abided by the coronavirus rule. There's a lot to be said for politics to go door to door knocking and to bring out the vote. And look at the way President Trump stumped all these states, which were marginal and swing states, and he held umpteen rallies. You've got to give it to him. Over 70, he's doing this sort of thing. So you bring out the vote. He brought out the vote. But we go back to the point that America is divided. You don't change people that much. They've made up their minds. And if one side wants to go to war and bring out their troops, we go to war, we bring out our troops. Democrats also came out in larger numbers, so it's not just the red states. I would like to hear James' point on this. I find that in America, what we are finding out is that there was a vision of America, which is a Wilsonian vision, which may be an elite vision of America shared by the East Coast and the West Coast. The Midwest, the states in the center, is it a very different America? Is the America first? You know, more comfortable with it. As you say, is it? I don't want to be so politically correct. I want to say exactly what I feel. Trump has made that possible. Maybe this is the norm.
You know, you refer to Wilsonian norms. Well, don't forget, Wilson was in favor of the U.S. joining the League of Nations, and the Senate voted it down because the U.S. was still isolationist. Mm-hmm. It's actually a fairly recent phenomena that the U.S. took a global stance, really, only since World War II.
Right.
And it's never sat comfortably with a lot of people. There's always been an America first, an isolationist strand from our founding when President Washington said, avoid foreign entanglements. And the sense that foreigners are not to be trusted. They will bring you down. This is why all these people emigrated, to get away from the foreign problems. Unfortunately, the world has changed since 1776.
Now, you both characterize this as a fight for the soul of America, but how much of this is what people would call corrosive identity politics?
That's part of it, but that's not all. It's economics as well. Many of the voters have embraced President Trump or voted for President Trump because, or Donald Trump, the candidate, because of his economic policies. He gave tax cuts, and some of them, the middle class is still experiencing the tax cuts in 2020. That goes next year, but he could renew that. But for the upper levels, you know, the really high income groups, it's tax cuts in perpetuity. He gave tax cuts, and there's been stimulus packages. And the Fed Reserve did not raise interest rate. In terms of economic policies, many Americans really are comfortable with it. They feel they are doing okay.
But just to press you on that point, though, are you saying that they voted for him because they benefited personally, individually
some
from the tax cuts? Or because the economic policies were beneficial? Because some people would say that a lot of the recovery that America has experienced was a product of Obama-era policies.
They don't think that whoever is holding office gets the praise, you get the blame as well. So he happens to be in the right spot. But I think he gave, and boy, did he publicize what he gave. The thing to also remember is that there's a phenomenon of the shy Trump voter. When all the posters go round, nobody will say, I will vote for Trump. I am told the pollsters found that if you ask the individual, he'll say, I'll vote for Biden, you know, I'm an independent. But if you asked the person being polled, and who will your neighbor vote for? They say, oh, Trump. There is a shy Trump voter, people who will not come out to say, I voted for Trump. until the cast a vote.
So I guess this leads into a conversation we need to have about polls, because for so long, so many polls were saying that Biden has a huge lead since he got the Democrat nomination. And in fact, in the weeks leading up to the election, it seems that he had an uptick in his support level. So what went wrong? How did polls get it so wrong? Because in many states, his lead was 1-2%. What do you think, James?
Well, one thing to think, keep in mind is Biden is going to win more votes than any candidate ever has. And he'll probably get about 4 million more votes than Trump. So to that level, the polls are sort of accurate. Where they were inaccurate is on the state-by-state level. But there is clearly something wrong with polling. You saw it in the run-up to Brexit, where the polls are wrong, in the Australian elections, where everyone predicted Labour was going to win, and now again with the U.S. election. So clearly, there's something in the methodology that needs work. And thank God I'm not a pollster. I have no idea what it is.
I was watching, whether it was CNN or Fox, I flipped, so I can't remember who said what. But they had a voter come out of the booth, and he said that, you know, until I entered the booth to vote, I really didn't know who I was going to vote for. So you can have that sort of kind of voter. And also a weak voter, weak leaning one side because of stumping, the rallies, someone knocking on the door. At the last minute, you could switch one way or the other.
Let's turn a bit to Joe Biden's campaign, because for a while he's actually been described as a bland establishment man of sorts and a compromise candidate that all the Democrats could get behind. After all, they wanted to vote for somebody who could unseat Trump in the White House. How did he get so many votes, and how did he manage to turn Arizona, you think, James?
Well, first, how did he get so many votes? Many, many people voted against Trump. As one said, I would have voted for the dog against Trump. So that was a large part of it. As far as why he won a state like Arizona, that's a very specific issue with Arizona, where the demographics are changing. A lot of people, especially from California, have moved in. A lot of Hispanics have gotten citizenship. A lot of young Hispanics have now reached voting age. A lot of older people who were upset with Trump's response to COVID changed their vote. My mother happens to live in Arizona, and she changed from a Trump voter to a Biden voter because she was disgusted with what she said. He's so uncouth. So yeah. Things like that.
I'd like to say something about the Hispanic vote. And in Arizona, I think, James, it's fair to say that there are more Mexicans, Hispanic. It's not just the Hispanic vote, because you've got to break down the Hispanics into Puerto Ricans, Cubans, Cuban Americans and Venezuela Americans. And that's why Trump did so well in Florida, because it's the Puerto Ricans who are fundamentalist Christians. Apparently, there's a big group there. And there are the Cuban Americans who objected to so-called the socialist identity of the Democratic Party. And Trump pushed that view. And also the Venezuelans, they all don't want socialism. So they are all for Trump in Florida. But elsewhere, when you get Mexicans and the way Mexican has been the football in the 4 years of Trump and the wall, build the wall, they were not so keen to give the vote, I guess, to the Republican Party and to President Trump.
I mean, so far we've talked about voter inclinations and where the two candidates stand going into the election, but how much do you think last-minute issues also determine the fate of this election? Number one was, say, Trump catching COVID but also recovering from it. And then on the other hand, for Joe Biden, his comments on fracking.
Trump may have lost some votes because he got COVID, but I'm betting he got more because he recovered so spectacularly. As you said, the 74-year-old mildly obese man having that sort of schedule and having that sort of energy, that was really impressive. So I think people saw that and compared it to Biden, who was fine, but he didn't display the energy that Trump had.
So it's a plus for him overall, for Trump.
You know, this is pure gut. I have no data.
I kind of winced a bit when in the second debate when Joe Biden said he would do away with the oil and gas industry. And I swallowed and I said, oh gosh, Pennsylvania is going to affect the votes. Joe Biden stood for decency, honesty. And he said he was un-Trump. He was not Trump, the anti-Trump, all those values. It had an appeal. But between the economy and that character, the economy pulled just as strongly. You see this very close fight. I'm beginning to wonder, James, whether climate change, whilst everybody's for it, is not such a great sell during an election. at top of the manifesto, I'm for climate change policies, I have to add. Let me clarify that. But this is a political reality. In Australia, it didn't work for Bill Shorten. He was so high on climate change and it didn't work for him. I wonder whether some of the Republicans felt their jobs might be affected.
You know, that's a great question. Before you answer that, James, I think climate change, people have said, have pulled in two directions. Number one, on the one hand, Biden was able to energize a lot of the youth votes who are very passionate about climate change. But on the other hand, of course, the older population, people in the Midwest who are concerned about oil, would probably look at it with some suspicion as well. Where do you think overall it landed for Biden in that sense, James?
As you said, it energized the youth vote. I think it further energized the coastal folks. Trump's base is typically lower middle class who worries about how I'm going to put food on the table tomorrow. Yeah. Climate change is tomorrow's problem. Part of the problem is no one's explained the economic impact of climate change on them except in negative terms. Yeah. It has to be demonstrated to why actually it might create more jobs, it might lower their energy costs, it might make them more secure. Just saying I'm against fracking doesn't help with those Biden should have been trying to reach.
Do you think that single issues might have motivated more voters to come out and vote? To my mind, I think the issue of Supreme Court judge nominations was key. A lot of people in 2016 had said they had voted for Trump on that basis itself. What do you think, Ambassador Chan?
I'm sure it worked both ways. For the Democrats, it was something to go against Trump for. For the Trump supporters, the Republicans, they are so grateful President Trump is there and brought now a conservative court into being, 6-3, with the appointment of Amy Coney Barrett. It is very important. Single issues are important. And we all have issues. You vote for something and there's a combination of issues, but at the time you vote on that particular day, sometimes one issue becomes more prominent because of an announcement here and there. For instance, I think for the African Americans, the racial issue, you know, and racial equality was a big issue. Gender diversity, gender equality for many women was an important issue. These issues played their part. But unless we go back to do an analysis, you don't know exactly what actual impact that issue has. But I'm sure they added up.
One thing that struck me throughout this conversation so far is the discussion about what is energizing people to come out and vote. And James, you mentioned, for instance, climate change being an issue that is important, but a lot of the economic impact, a lot of the long-term implications for people have not been dissected very well. The question, therefore, is, do you foresee populism driving American politics more so in the years to come? Because it's these issues that are popular, that are emotional, that deal with identity politics almost, that really get the vote out.
It's hard to say if Trump is a singular phenomenon because of who he is and how he behaves and his reality TV star persona. I'm not sure a lot of other politicians can do that. So that's one thing. The other thing is demographics in the U.S. is changing. The white, male, non-college educated demographic shrinks every year. So will the same populist message resonate to the same extent 4 years hence? I would think not. You never know. I would also expect that the Democrats are going to look at what happened now and do their own analysis and say, okay, here we have to do a better job of reaching out to these people. And I'd like to know your opinion, Ambassador. I was hoping personally that U.S. might join TPP under a Biden administration, but I'm concerned that with this result, that's going to be harder.
Let me take the TPP question first because it's easier for me. I've been thinking about it. Whilst that may be the immediate conclusion, I think it's not that easy for the United States to join TPP immediately because the CPTPP, which came in place of TPP led by Japan and Australia, dropped about 22 provisions of the original TPP, which was at the heart of the matter for the Americans, you know. Now, does the United States coming in mean they want to restore those 22 provisions? And I'm not sure it is so okay with the other members of CPTPP now. It's going to be a hard push. Will America enter TPP or CPTPP now if those provisions were not there in full? this is an issue. Some people think it might be important for America just to sign the digital economy agreements, just separate agreements, you know, so that that may be the first step rather than to go into CPTPP immediately.
Now, Ambassador Chan, you've mentioned that no matter who becomes president, of course, Asia and Singapore will be prepared to work with him. But do you think Asia has a preference? Because on the one hand, Trump has been seen as tough but good for Asia. He's been a bit disruptive when it comes to trade, but he's taken on China when it comes to the South China Sea, and he's taken a tough stance towards North Korea.
I think some Asian countries think it is better. Not all share that view. There was a piece by an Indonesian strategic thinker. He was formerly ambassador in Washington. And he said that, you know, most of Southeast Asia don't like and agree and don't agree with the sharp, hostile rhetoric of the Trump administration towards China. It depends on who you read. In some ways, people will say, look back and say, President Trump, by being very tough with China, forced China to renegotiate some things. America has come back in a way to Southeast Asia with a very visible presence. Mind you, President Obama, in his second term, when Ash Carter was a defense secretary, he was coming back with the FENOPS, but it was the tail end of the administration. And I think General Mattis, when he took over as the defense secretary of Obama, did it, but quieter. He did it as routine. The presence built up. Now we have concerns about Taiwan, the Taiwan Straits, and also sort of accidental clashes in the South China Sea.
James, what in your mind would be different for Biden presidency if he were to win when it comes to U.S. foreign policy in Asia? And how different would that be from an Obama administration era U.S. foreign policy towards Asia?
The one area where there's consensus in Washington is China. So I think a Biden administration would continue a tough line with China. But the difference would be they would be more proactive reaching out on issues of global concern, climate change, health, that sort of thing, to work together. So cooperate when you can, confront when you must. It will be the policy. Therefore, trade, for instance, I don't think there'll be much of a let up on demanding an equal level playing field on trade issues. South China Sea, I think FENOPS will continue. Efforts to work with ASEAN to get the code of conduct negotiations to be meaningful, and China's efforts to continually drag that out will continue. I think the level of rhetoric will be ratcheted down will be the big thing. And how different from the Obama administration is, when Obama was president, the American business community was still full on board with engaging with China. They're not anymore. They have finally thrown in the towel, a lot of them, and said, too hard, too much IP stolen, go for it. Also, there are elements within the Obama administration who were so focused on Russia that they just wanted to keep China on side. And again, I think that has fallen away.
How focused do you think a Biden presidency will be on foreign policy in Asia, given that people have said if he wins the presidency, the Senate will still be Republican? He's got a lot to do also to rein in far-left elements of his party.
The focus will be on domestic policy, there's no doubt. Rebuilding the economy, dealing with the COVID epidemic, getting employment back up, dealing with the inequality, which is such a concern. That said, all the Biden foreign policy advisors I know have said Asia remains the most important area for every geopolitical, economic, all aspects. We will see a lot of engagement. I think President Biden would go to the ASEAN summit and the APEC summit. I think it'll be a big change, understanding in Asia you have to show up. I think that will happen.
I see you nodding your head, Ambassador.
No, I agree with everything James said. And indeed, America and American politicians have to understand that it matters in Asia, being there, showing up. I don't know why it's such a hard sell to the United States. I was told when I was ambassador, you can't get a president to the Asia twice a year. I said, why not? It's absurd because everyone recognizes it's a dynamic region. The growth is all there. The major countries are there. Great powers are there. That may be changing. You know, I would like to make a point about, go back to the progressiveness, the leftward drift of the Democratic Party. I think with the results now in Congress, The Democrats lost some seats in Congress this time. They did not recapture Senate. And the people that they targeted really kept their seats, you know, Lindsey Graham, Mitch McConnell. It may be a signal that the electorate doesn't want such a leftward progressive policy. And maybe Nancy Pelosi, the speaker, will listen. That's how it works.
But with Biden having to contend with a Republican Senate, though, do you see deadlock to be the new normal?
I think it's going to be very tough. Should it result in his being the President Biden, it's not going to be easy for him. He will be blocked all the way. Mitch McConnell, Senator Mitch McConnell, said when President Obama was elected, it's his job to make him a one-term president. And I would say that will happen to Joe Biden, should he be president. Which brings me to the point that we have both not mentioned, James, that in the United States, advantage to the incumbent is always there. Why is Trump having so many votes? Why has he kept the votes? Because he's the incumbent.
That's absolutely correct. This is only the fourth time in U.S. history the incumbent has lost.
If it results in his losing.
Maybe I'm giving away my views.
Right. No, I do agree, because I think one way would be I can see a lot of litigation, and in the end, it may be the Supreme Court that decides who is going to be the next president of the United States.
Do you foresee the Supreme Court being involved? And do you think that Amy Coney Barrett's appointment would play a factor in this?
Well, look, what would be the case for bringing an election result to the Supreme Court? It would be the date on ballots or signatures or something like that. But signatures don't tend to go to the Supreme Court. Those are resolved at the local level. So I think Trump will have a hard time finding a case with which to bring it to the Supreme Court. And as I mentioned, if the margins hold in Wisconsin and Michigan, that's a lot of votes to make up. And I'm not sure the court would hear the case.
Yeah. Actually, and it's got to go through different levels first.
That's right.
District, you know, state, yeah. Before you even, yeah. And the appeals as well.
Right. Yeah. And as we discussed, the Democrats have been seeing this coming for months. It's very clear they have lawyers who've been working on this for a long time, getting ready for this sort of effort. The Trump campaign saw the mail-in ballots, the absentee ballots, as going to be the issue, which is why they were trying to fight it for months.
Yeah.
So it's coming to a head now.
So Ambassador Chan, just rounding off, do you think that means that governments should hold off congratulating any winners until even possibly January?
One of the things that I'm quite proud I did was during the Bush-Gore election, I was asked if a letter should be sent because Gore declared he was the winner. And I said, hold on, you don't have to be the first letter that arrives in the White House. And it proved to be the right advice, because later Gore withdrew his concession. After a month, it turned out to be Bush.
That's why she was there for so long. She made good decisions.
So just closing off, did you have any parting shots in the U.S. election for our listeners as they tune in to figure out who's going to win the White House?
Well, if current trends hold, it looks like Biden will win. As the ambassador said, there'll be a lot of litigation between then and the actual confirmation of the winner. Patience will be important. But the other thing to keep in mind is there's a lot of predictions of violence at the polls and all that sort of problem. 160-something million people voted, and there are no incidents that I've heard of to be reported. As passionate as the American people are about this campaign, I do think they respect the process. And I think the outcome, after a lot of Sturm und Drang, will come out okay.
I share the same feeling, too. The process was very smooth. You may find one or two eruptions of conflict should the counting not go the way some people would like, and if there are some indiscreet remarks by different people, you know, about stepping in to save the result or whatever, but they would be isolated conflicts. We should not overread what this means. And in spite of all the fears, it's come out better than we thought. But the elections will take a few days to complete, and maybe a week, in another week, to really find out what's happening.
Keep in mind the late 60s when the U.S. was losing Vietnam, inflation was rampant, Japan was going to be the new economic power. There was social turmoil, riots in the streets, half of Washington burned down. And I remember as a kid reading, "This is the end of the United States." I'm hoping the phoenix rises again.
Thank you very much, Ambassador Chan, James Caruso. That was Ambassador Chan Hing-chi and Bauer Asia Group Managing Director James Caruso. Stay tuned to CNA for the U.S. presidential race as results stream in over the next few days, perhaps even weeks. This has been Heart of the Matter. Credit for this episode also goes to Crispina Robert, our podcast editor, and Erin Low, our research writer. And until next time, I'm Lin Su Ling signing off.